Welcome to Reality Based Fitness, the voice of reason. In this podcast, we explore the fields of strength and conditioning, human performance, injury prevention, and nutrition through the lens of science and critical thinking. Hey everybody, this is Keith Snydman, and we're really glad to have another amazing nutrition guest today. I'm going to go ahead and let my co-host Patrick Ward introduce him. Patrick, take it away.
Hey, thanks a lot, Keith, and this is great. We really appreciate everyone who's been listening, and we got some great feedback on our last show with Brad Pilon, so we decided to bring back another guy, another nutrition guy here. I'm really excited. We have Lyle McDonald on the phone today. I'm a big fan of his. I've been reading his stuff since about 2000. Started with the ketogenic diet book and read all his books from there, and then his articles on his website. And the thing that I like the most about Lyle's stuff is that he's very evidence-based. So he goes out, he reads all the research, he reads all the complicated biology, biochemistry stuff. And then he boils it down to the practical information that we can take away from it and use for ourselves or for our clients. So I think everybody's going to get a lot out of today's interview, and hopefully Lyle debunk some myths for us. Just a little background on Lyle. In 1993, he graduated from UCLA with a degree in exercise physiology. And over the last 20 years, he spent time studying human physiology and, more importantly, the science of training, performance, nutrition, and fat loss. And his studies have led him to publish 7 books on a variety of topics, ranging from diet and fat loss, exercise, and sports nutrition. And in addition to that, he's contributed articles to several major online and print publications. And when he isn't spending time reading research, answering questions on his forum, or writing articles for his website, bodyrecomposition.com, Lyle can be seen at the Olympic Oval in Salt Lake City, Utah, where he trains in speed skating. Lyle, thanks for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thanks, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, I'd just like to get started by asking you just if you could give us some basic kind of dieting basic information. You know, every year more and more diet books are written, and people are still getting fatter. And unfortunately, most of these books aren't founded on science. They're more based on anecdotal reports or some sort of voodoo scientific principles. So I guess, you know, some of the big questions are, you know, is a calorie a calorie, or is there something magical about not eating carbohydrates other than the fact that just eliminating an entire food group lowers your overall caloric intake? You know, what basic information do people need to know about dieting that they aren't getting from, you know, the charlatans who are publishing all these books and taking advantage of the misinformed consumer, or those spewing nonsense on shows like The Biggest Loser and the vast number of fitness magazines on the market today?
Well, I think speaking sort of kind of generally, actually, I did an interview recently and someone asked me a similar question. You know, what if I had a single point to make to everyone regarding either diet or training or what have you, what would it be? And what you tend to find is that all diets essentially are trying to work through the same sort of process. You know, diet books will always say, you know, you don't have to count calories to lose weight, and then they'll trick you into doing it one way or another, whether it's through food combining, whether it's through eliminating foods that people tend to overeat. You know, what happens with a lot of these popular diet books is some single bit of nutritional information comes out, and then someone manages to write a 300-page book about that single soundbite, with 150 pages of that being recipes. In any case, what I tell people is to focus on the commonalities. Is there's a million different diets. People have succeeded or not succeeded on anything you care to name, from low-carb, high-fat, high-carb, low-fat, the zone, you name it, somebody has succeeded on it and somebody's failed on it. And what I tell people is to focus on the commonalities rather than the details. And I think that's kind of what you're getting at, is what are the commonalities of all sort of successful weight loss, fat loss programs. And what I find, at least, is if you look at all the different programs that are successful, whether the short or the long term, they all tend to share those same commonalities. So what are those commonalities? Clearly, the one that we can argue about, and people will make, you know, every decade people say calories don't count, and every decade that never works. and 40 years of research explain why that doesn't work, is it has to create an imbalance between energy intake, and which is from your food, and energy expenditure. And you can do that by changing your food intake. You can do that by changing your energy expenditure, your activity level. You can do it through a combination of the two. But if that's not there, if there's not that imbalance, there's absolutely no reason for the body to pull on stored energy, hopefully as body fat, so that you lose weight and lose body fat. Beyond that, you can find so many different things that work in so many different situations, it's a little more difficult. The commonalities I tend to focus on, and I'll come back to this when we get into that whole calorie as a calorie debate, is all of my diets have to be based around adequate lean protein. I frankly tend to care less about any other aspect of it. Once you've got the calorie level set properly, if you're not getting sufficient dietary protein, nothing good can come of that. And, you know, of course, athletes and bodybuilders were saying this 20, 30 years ago, and they were sort of resoundingly dismissed by the medical mainstream. And now, of course, we have all the literature that says basically they were right. Dietary protein is the most hunger blunting of all three nutrients. And studies clearly show if you just feed people more lean protein, they tend to automatically eat less. So, you know, there's a quick, easy strategy. If you're hungry, eat more lean protein. It will fill you up. It will keep you full longer. You know, that alone is probably the thing that I think most people could probably benefit from. Past that, I also like to cite every one of my books. I talk on and on about the essential fatty acids, the omega-3s, the fish oils. Again, absolutely critical. Not only are they essential nutrient for both, you know, for health and everything else, they have been shown they may modulate appetite. They seem to improve fat loss a little bit. They decrease fat storage enzymes, decrease fat storage enzymes, increase fat mobilization enzymes, on and on and on. So those three things are kind of, you know, that's my basic diet paradigm is proper calorie level, adequate dietary protein, essential fatty acids. Everything else depends. And thing, you know, and this gets sort of into that is a calorie thing, which there's a bunch of different topics we can talk about. But what I found and why some people like me and other people get really frustrated with me is that there's no single approach that can be appropriate for all people. Mm-hmm. Athletes involved in high intensity activity tend to find that their performance goes down the toilet on very low carbohydrate diets. And there's ways around that, but as a generality, people who are extremely inactive, on the other hand, don't have a huge need for carbohydrates, not burning them. You don't need a lot of carbs when all you do is sit in front of a computer at work and maybe go walk on the treadmill a few times a day. So things like carbohydrate and fat intake tend to be kind of variable in the way I approach setting up diets, depending on the specifics. I would add a sort of another generality of diets is generally I do like to see sort of moderate fat intakes compared to either extreme. You know, people did the super low fat sub 10% diets back in the 80s, but they tend to be bland and tasteless, and adherence tends to be an issue for a lot of people because outside of an extremely tiny subgroup of sort of obsessive bodybuilders and athletes, people are not going to follow a diet that the food tastes like crap. So I like to see sort of as a generality, you know, 20 to 25% dietary fat as sort of a minimum. That can be adjusted upwards in some cases. That can be adjusted downwards in some very specific cases. But I guess those would be sort of my four very, very rough generalities. You know, set the appropriate calorie level, adequate dietary protein, essential fatty acids on a day-to-day basis, and then extending from that sort of moderate dietary fat from an adherence, taste, fullness type of standpoint.
And with the adequate protein, this is kind of away from the original question, but does the quality matter? I know people get into this whole like, I mean, I'm not a vegetarian, but I know people who are vegetarians are always asking, is soy really bad? People talk about breast cancer, and I'm like, well, a lot of people in China aren't dying of breast cancer, but they eat soy all the time.
It's true, although actually when you look at the total intake of soy in the Asian diets, it's actually not as large as a lot of people think.
Huh.
And this is the America has a fascinating way, because we don't do moderation in this country. And invariably what happens when anything comes along, whether it's a training intervention, and I think we'll talk about that later, or something nutritional, is people hear that, something is good for you. And in this case, you're talking about soy. Fiber was a good example. There's plenty of others. People then assume, well, if some is good, more is better. So they go from a little bit of soy every day is good for you to, well, I'm going to eat everything that has soy in it and supplement with soy protein. Then the backlash starts. Somebody has a problem, then you start getting books that are like, you know, the truth about soy, and people have these endless references that are, if you eat 200 grams of soy a day, it will cause problems. And the problem is not generally with the food or the nutrient, it's with the fact that people just go absolutely nuts with it.
Yeah.
So the actual soy intake among Asian cultures actually really isn't that high. And when you start looking at a lot of the research on phytoestrogens and health, phytoestrogens are a compound in soy that sort of mimic estrogen in the body, and that's where both the supposed health benefits for women and a lot of the controversy comes from, is when you start looking at that research in moderate amounts, phytoestrogens have almost no impact on the body one way or the other. And when you start pumping in tons of it, they start having they have potentially negative effects on hormone levels. So it tends to be a matter of degrees. Okay, so what's moderate and what's too much? The cutoff for phytoestrogen intake per day seems to be 50, 75 milligrams of active phytoestrogens per day. That's only about 25 grams of soy protein per day. So that's actually not very, and I wouldn't swear to this value, but in some of the papers that have talked about this, you know, the intake of soy protein in Asian cultures is only like 10, 20 grams a day. It's really not that high. So people went from this idea of getting a little bit to putting soy in just every single food they could, and that's where the problems start.
Yeah.
So back to your question about protein and protein quality. It can matter. There's sort of long been this issue about complete and incomplete proteins. And there's some truth to that. I mean, what you find is that pretty much all dietary proteins, with the exception of collagen and, there's another one I'm forgetting, the stuff that's in Jell-O, have all of the amino acids. It's just a matter of what the ratios are. And vegetable proteins tend to be limited, have a limited amount of certain amino acids, and animal-based proteins tend to have all of them in the amount sufficient to sort of cover human requirements. That really only becomes a huge issue when people are eating small amounts of a single dietary protein. So the whole issue of a protein quality is just enormously important if you're dealing with, say, a third world country where people get 20 grams of, you know, wheat protein per day and that's it. In that situation, you can have enormous advantages by putting in more of the limiting amino acid. For the typical American who's eating, you know, 100 to 150 grams of protein per day from mixed sources, a lot of that tends to become a whole lot less relevant. Simply by dint of, one, the mixture of proteins, you'll end up getting enough amino acids, and simply the quantity will make it sort of a non-issue. Sort of a bigger issue with vegetable proteins, actually, is that they are not absorbed and digested as well as animal source proteins. So with animal source proteins, you typically see digestion rates about 90-95%. So if you eat 100 grams of animal protein, you'll absorb about 95 grams of it. With vegetable proteins, it can actually be as low as about 80%, just because of the increased fiber and other nutrients. So if someone is eating a predominantly vegetable-based protein diet, that can increase their absolute protein requirements. They may need to eat slightly more total protein to compensate for that, or make sure and get a mixture of, you know, vegetable proteins with some animal proteins or high quality protein or milk or what have you.
Cool. All right, this is Keats here. Hey, Lyle, switching gears a little bit, I actually want to go back and we'll address your protein book here in a little bit, but I want to talk about the book you wrote called Your Flexible Guide to Dieting, which
yes,
is definitely, I think, probably one of your most accessible ones. And the thing we really like about it is that it's not your typical diet book that's just you know, kind of eliminating this or that and just giving you a bunch of you know, recipes and this and that. But you really deal with the psychological side of things and sort of human nature and deprivation and the fact that we can't be perfect eaters all the time, and how that's such a bad goal is to be perfect. Can you talk a little bit about that book and kind of what your message is with that? And just sort of the whole struggle that, you know, humans go through
when it comes to dieting and like all these like sort of mind games that people will play with themselves?
Absolutely. The Guide to Flexible Dieting is funny. It was sort of an unusual book for me because, like you said, it wasn't really a specific diet. It's also probably the thing I've written that I wish more people would read, but has been the least popular, or at least the least purchased. And I think it's simply, I think there's a couple of reasons for it. One is the title is awful, but all the titles of all my books are awful. And so I don't think that's it specifically, but there's a tendency among dieters. And again, I don't know how much of an international audience you have. I have no idea if this is true of other countries, but it's certainly true in the U.S. People always want harder, more extreme, faster, better, more miserable. And part of me thinks it's just an outcome of sort of our puritanical upbringing and the folks who originally founded this country. I don't really know, or it may just be endemic to dieters. So I wrote this book, and as you described, sort of what I looked at was not so much the specifics of the diet or what diet someone should do, but why diets fail. Because I think, honestly, in a lot of ways, that's really the issue. I mean, like I said earlier, all diets work, at least for a little while, at least for the time that the person stays with it, but people don't stick to diets in the long term. And to me, that's the more interesting question. I mean, we've got 40 years worth of research. We know how to get people to lose weight. It's really not that difficult, fundamentally. The problem is getting them to do it. And then not only getting them to do it, but getting them to maintain it in the long term. So I tried to look at some of the reasons that I thought both diets could fail dieters as well as dieters could fail their diets, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think I said that right. And that's sort of what – and so some of that is behavioral. And one of the things that I find, and I'm sure you guys have found with clients, is people – have this expectation or this idea that anything less than 100% perfection equals failure. And in research, they actually talk about folks who that they sort of there has been quite a bit of behavioral research and psychological research on diet. And one of the data sets examines what they call rigid versus flexible dieters. And rigid dieters tend to be the ones who are just the type A of the diet world. You know, they're either on a diet or off the diet, and they're either completely eliminating, extremely dieting, or they're just not, whereas flexible dieters tend to show more flexible dieting behaviors, which I'll get back to in just a second. And what's interesting is that the rigid dieters tend to be the ones who are more prone to binge, more prone to break their diet, and they tend to weigh more. So in the long term, at least, those types of behaviors tend to be self-defeating. Now, of course, we all know that person who, in the short term at least, can make that work absolutely fantastically. And, you know, for the 6 to 8 weeks that they are on their diet, the weight comes off, everything's great, but then the problem starts. And the example that I've been using for probably 10 years and will continue to use, the one I put in the book, is it's that I ate a cookie syndrome. And so, you know, the dieter is moving right along. 5 or 6 days, absolute perfect. They haven't done anything to break their diet. Whatever, it doesn't even matter what it is. And then in a moment of weakness or whatever, they have that cookie, and then suddenly the guilt hits. And suddenly it's the, you know what, I've blown it. I've blown my entire diet. I ate that cookie. I'm a horrible person. I was weak. I'm pathetic. I deserve to be unhappy. Give me the bag. And then suddenly, you know, we've all, and it's interesting actually, back when I was personal training, and I'm sure you guys have seen this too, training is the same way. People, they make every workout, the first 3 weeks are great, then they miss that one workout, something comes up, family, whatever it is, and the mental state is, you know what, I've ruined it, I've blown all the progress I've made, forget it, give me the bag, you know, I'm not going back to the gym, I've completely screwed myself because I'm undedicated, and it just, again, that type of attitude can work stunningly well in the short term, but in the long term, with the majority of people, I find that it tends to be very self-defeating. And what people have to realize is that in the big scheme of things, even those little things are really no big deal. And if they would take the moment to sort of think about it objectively, let's say you've been dieting 6 days, you've had a nice 500-calorie deficit, you know, that's nearly a pound of fat, and then you have a cookie that's 100 calories. Realistically, can that possibly have ruined the 6 days? Of course not. The numbers simply don't add up. Now, it can become a problem if you make it a problem. If eating that 100, you decide, I've blown my diet, I'm going to eat 2,000 more calories of cookies, well, you've just taken what is really a complete non-issue, and you've made it an enormous issue, simply through the way that you sort of mentally parsed that experience. So what I tried to get into in the book was not only those ideas that being more flexible with your diet, again, up to a point, clearly you have to be on a diet for it to work, but being more flexible to some degree in the long term improves adherence. And it's mainly through, there are physiological reasons, but there's also psychological reasons. And sort of here's another example. People will come onto my forum and they'll say, you know, I want a diet, but I can't imagine never having French fries ever again, like, or whatever the food they happen to crave happens to be. And I'll tell them, well, why does that have to be the case? Why is there some fundamental reason why you can't work this food into a proper long-term weight loss diet? And that's sort of how I approach things in flexible dieting, is telling people, you know, if you're getting it right most of the time, you're still ahead of the game. And again, I'm sure you guys teach the same thing in terms of training to clientele. You know, if you're doing what you need to do 80% of the time, you're way ahead of the majority and you're going to be making progress. The other 20% is really a non-issue, again, unless you make it an issue. Now, there does seem to be sort of some innate differences in personality profile and how well or how poorly people can handle this. And that's a whole separate discussion, how much of this is actually modifiable and how much of it is innate and how much of it is learned and what have you. And it seems like the people who are kind of naturally flexible dieters tend to just do that. They just do it intuitively. And the people who are extremists and the rigid dieters, they're just kind of wired to be that way. So in the book, the way I sort of approached it was what I'm going to describe as structured flexible dieting, which is a horrible contradiction, but what I try to do is say that, okay, for the average person, they may not be able to sort of intuitively let this happen, so I gave them some strategies, which I called free meals, structured refeeds, and then the full diet break, which I would like to talk about, and gave them sort of a schedule to follow based on starting body fat percentage and how much they're training, and basically tell them to plan these activities into their diet rather than trying to let it happen sort of intuitively or randomly. And the reason for that is that I find with that, making that way the dieter is in control of the diet rather than the other way around. By having these things sort of planned in a structured fashion, I think they still have the same benefit, but it puts the dieter back in control. And sort of in that vein, I'm going to talk about the three strategies, but I'm going to do it in reverse order because the full diet break, which is something I wish more people would do, I think is almost the most fascinating of the three. And that idea, it wasn't new. I'd seen people recommend sort of taking a couple weeks between periods of active weight loss, but it came out of this weird little study I found a bunch of years ago by one of the big obesity researchers. And what they wanted to look at was, what happens when people break their diet? Behaviorally, what do people do when they go off their diet and start eating, you know, start overeating again and gaining back the weight? So they recruited a bunch of people and they put them on a pretty hard 6 weeks, as I recall, diet. And then they said, okay, we want you to take 2 weeks off your diet so that they could see what happened. How much weight did they regain? How did their eating behaviors change? What happened? So folks dieted for 6 weeks and they gave them 2 weeks off. And then they brought them back in. And what they found was completely in contrast to what they actually wanted to study. Most of the folks hadn't really gained more than a pound or two. No one had lost control of their eating. And sort of more importantly, the subjects really had no problems going back to their diet. So at a fundamental level, the study completely failed. They failed utterly to examine what they wanted to examine. But they made a really cool observation. And what they thought was that, well, we instructed these people to take this two-week break as part of the research study, and that seemed to be fundamentally, mentally, and psychologically different than what happens when most people break their diet. Most people, like I said, break their diet. They go to a party. They go out to dinner. They have something that's not, quote-unquote, on the diet. They feel like they're a failure. Boom, the post-diet binge starts. In this case, the subjects seem to think that, well, the two-week break is what the researchers want us to do. It was no big deal. It was a controlled part of what they thought they were supposed to do, and they didn't by being in control of what was happening, rather than feeling that loss of control, they stayed in control. And I think that's where a lot of these strategies that I recommend, the reason that I tell people to sort of make them planned and structured is because I think it lets people maintain control of their diet. So rather than, God, I went to a party and I didn't want to be antisocial and I felt like I had to eat a piece of cake and felt guilty and, you know, give me the cake, it was, well, you know, I've been good on my diet for the last 4 days. I know I have a party coming up. I'm going to plan my free meal around that. I'm in control. I get to choose what I'm doing. That there's a mental shift that I find occurs for a lot of people that allows them to stay in control and be able to go back to their diet.
Hmm. Yeah. Wow. That's good stuff. So we've been talking about diet and stuff. So I think it's fair that we talk a little bit about exercise along with that. So, you know, when it comes to exercise for fat loss, you know, we know obviously that we have to do some sort of strength training in order to maintain whatever muscle mass we have. And we also know that we have to do some metabolic or conditioning work or whatever people call it this month to help burn some calories.
Right.
And that leads people into high intensity interval training.
Right.
And, you know, the common thought process, again, getting back to what you said about people in this country is, you know, if a little's good, more must be better. People want to do 4 to 5 days of resistance training and an equal or sometimes even greater amount of intense interval training on top of that while all being in a caloric deficit, which means their ability to recover from training is impaired. Can you talk about the problem with this and maybe some of the typical pitfalls or traps that people fall into when setting up a training program to lose body fat?
Well, I think you pretty much summed it up in your introduction, so I'm not sure I'm going to have a whole lot to add to that. But, you know, the traditional approach to fat loss to exercise for fat loss has been, you know, well, strength training actually has only recently sort of come into vogue among research types and obesity types. And again, there was a place that the athletes and the bodybuilders were really ahead of the game with the fact that that was critical to maintain lean body mass. But traditionally, it's been cardio, low intensity cardio, and more low intensity cardio. And clearly that actually, you know, people, it's funny, you're seeing some of the criticisms of, oh, low-intensity cardio makes you fat and doesn't work, and I just want to point them to 4 decades of contest lean bodybuilders and go, really? Because they've clearly made that work in conjunction with a diet. And to say it doesn't work or makes you fatter, I think, is really unbelievably disingenuous. I will agree, though, that it has been sort of overemphasized, and yes, the pendulum sort of got way too far to one side, where all you should do is just hours and hours of low intensity activity, and beyond other issues, there's the fact that the average person simply doesn't have the time to actually do that. So somewhere in, I don't know, I remember first reading about it in the late 80s, mid 90s. You know, there was research coming out that interval training, where you know you're alternating very short high intensity bouts with periods of easier work was at least as effective, if not possibly superior, for fat loss to traditional low-intensity cardio. It was more time efficient. Like there's no doubt that it certainly has benefits, although if people would actually look at some of the original research, the effect on fat loss is not nearly as great as many people make it sound. I mean, the original Tremblay study, which is what everyone likes to sort of quote, was the first. And I actually think I'm one of the first people to have mentioned interval training in my first book in fat loss when I cited that study. The fat loss, you know, they compared intervals 3 days a week to like 5 hours of cardio, and fat loss over 12 weeks was about a kilo. So that's 2 pounds over 12 weeks, which I would say, you know, whoop-de-doo. The effects, the differences really aren't enormous. And one thing is that, you know, diet wasn't controlled, and of course they weren't doing any sort of training. So sort of to your point, what I talked about earlier, people have gotten on this interval bandwagon where having been convinced that not only is low-intensity cardio bad, but if some interval training is good, then more must be better. And people end up sort of combining a lot of different things from different types of studies and putting them all together, and they're just getting blown up. You know, again, we can go back to the bodybuilders, and yes, there's other issues and drugs and things like that, but bodybuilders typically did, you know, resistance training 4 or 5 times a week. Really all they could recover from was low-intensity cardio, and I think that's a big part of the reason that they kind of went to that. I mean, if you're in the weight room pounding yourself, there's only so much energy to go around, especially when you're on a diet. And trying to add more high-intensity activity to that tends to cause problems. So what I find happening is people are not looking at sort of the overall load and the overall pattern of what's going on, and something has to give. And what I see happening is people, they want to do, you know, starting strength and do heavy strength training full body 3 times a week. And then they want to add metabolic weight training on 3 alternate days. And then they want to add interval training every morning. And then they want to do that without eating any carbs. And they wonder why 6 weeks later they just overtrained themselves into the absolute ground. You know, and the point I try to make is, you know, most elite athletes only do two high intensity sessions a week, maybe 3 if they're really at a high level, have really good therapy, and have some recuperative substances. And yet they're not dieting, and yet the average dieter thinks that they can train high intensity 5-6 days a week on a low calorie diet, and they wonder why bad things happen.
Well, also their intervals are like, people are always talking about sprinters and marathon runners. And if you look at a sprinter, they're not doing, you know, 30 seconds of work, 30 seconds of rest. You know, they're running, you know, 100 or 40 meters maybe, and then they're resting for like 3 to 5 minutes or doing
Or sometimes even longer. They'll go 40 meters, rest 10 minutes, 60 meters, rest 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, where they get most of their leanness and their fat loss, if they need it, is through the lower intensity metabolic work they do. Sprinters do something called extensive tempo work, where they are doing sort of an interval program, but it's actually fairly low intensity, and they get it through volume. So yeah, that whole sprinting versus marathoning thing just really gets on my nerves, because it's a really bad example.
Yeah.
Not to mention that if you look at most elite sprinters, they looked like that before they started sprinting. They're typically lean and muscular to begin with, and they just became bigger versions of their lean muscular self as they got older. And people are like, have you ever seen a fat sprinter? Well, actually, yeah, there's a couple of them at the Oval. There's a couple of fat white guys I've seen training as short sprinters, and yeah, they're plenty fat. So sprinting is not magic. Anyway, I'm not going to go off on that. So the point I try to make to folks when it comes to fat loss diets is something's going to have to give. And I'm not anti-interval training, which I think a lot of people have gotten that idea. People are like, Lyle is against high-intensity activity. No, I'm absolutely not, because it can certainly – all types of training, I feel, have some benefit at some place, same as with diets. All diets can be appropriate sort of under the right conditions. It's just the key is knowing what condition. And it's not that intervals are bad or intervals will kill you or won't work. It's a matter of you have to integrate – that with the rest of your training. And again, something has to give. And there's this weird idea, and it really came out of 80s drug-fueled bodybuilding, that when you're training for fat loss, you should increase your volume and frequency of training. And I think if people would take a step back to think about that, that's ridiculous. The one time you can't, your recovery is going to be massively impaired, is when you're dieting. And that's when you're going to try to train more and harder. That was only made possible because that's when anabolic steroids came into the game, and they prevented muscle loss, and they let guys not overtrain as badly while they were contest dieting. And for natural dieters, they just absolutely get broken off. So what I tend to recommend is, again, like I said, I have no problem with a mixture of things. It's just a matter of something's going to have to give. So I think all fat loss diets need to maintain some amount of heavy strength training. And that's simply a function of you need that stimulus to tell your body, quote unquote, to maintain muscle mass. You know, there's this other idea that again came out of drug-fueled bodybuilding that you should cut the weight and go to higher reps and train for cuts and all this kind of nonsense. And when natural athletes do that, the muscle mass goes away. Because if you remove the tension stimulus, if you remove the signal that tells your body to maintain muscle mass, the muscle goes away. But that doesn't mean you should try to train full volume. That doesn't mean you should do 5x5 on 6 exercises 3 times a week. It means that you need to maintain a lower volume of heavy work. And I typically recommend, you know, you can actually reduce your volume and frequency pretty significantly and maintain strength pretty long term. I'm sure you guys have seen that with the folks you train. You know, when they're in season and they don't have a lot of time or energy to lift weights, you cut the weight training back to 30 minutes twice a week, and they don't really lose much strength for 8 or 12 weeks. So that's my first recommendation, is to cut back the total number of work sets. You can cut back the frequency of heavy training, but the key is you have to maintain the weight on the bar. You have to keep the weight heavy, or at least as heavy as you can relative to what you were lifting. That tends to allow more room for these other modalities. So if you want to lift, you know, do a short full body strength muscle mass maintenance workout twice a week, that'll let you do some metabolic weight training, you know, kettlebell stuff, CrossFit-y type stuff, that sort of training, full body metabolic type weight training, you know, then you can add that a couple times a week. Or if you want to do heavy stuff 4 days a week, you know, an upper lower split, the heavy work should only take you about 20, 25 minutes. You go in, you hit two or three exercises for two heavy sets of eight. Now you've got 30 or 40 minutes, then do the metabolic work afterwards. So you can get four shorter metabolic sessions after that. For interval training, you know, with that, you have to start looking at, you know, what's the leg training? If you're trying to squat heavily twice a week and you're trying to do run interval training twice a week, you're training your legs heavily four times a week. Would you do that when you're not dieting? Maybe. Do you think you can recover that when you are dieting? Well, you might think you can, and you might for a little while, but there's a lot of people on the internet who are like, I don't understand why my legs are tired all the time. Well, gee, I have an idea for you that you might want to consider. So, again, I don't have a problem with doing intervals. It's just something has to give, and this might be a case where, you know, you cut. If you want to do intervals a couple times a week, whether it's running sprints or bike intervals or Tabatas or whatever you're into, you may need to cut your heavy leg training back to once a week, and that will maintain your leg strength. But if you think you can squat heavily three times a week and run intervals heavily three times a week on the alternate days, you're in for a humongous surprise when your legs fall off. Sort of in that vein, something I actually recommend that is a little atypical, but that I found years ago actually worked for me. Back when I was inline skating, I was trying to integrate a lot of heavy leg training with interval work. And I actually found that doing the intervals on the same day as the heavy leg training worked better. And this seems kind of counterintuitive. You're like, well, doesn't that make for one hell of a day? And the answer is yes, it does, but you get more systemic recovery. Yeah. So if you consider a situation where someone's lifting legs like Monday, Friday, and they want to do intervals Wednesday, Saturday, well, legs are getting hammered 4 days a week. If you'd move your intervals to, say, Monday, Friday morning, if you've got the ability to do it, and then come back and lift in the evening, you still get the same number of workouts in, but your legs are only getting hit twice a week. And I found that my recovery was significantly, or in some cases you lift, if you can't do two workouts a day, you lift first, and then you do the intervals afterwards. And it makes the intervals a lot less fun than they would already be, but again, I just found that recovery was sort of overall better that way. You know, or if you want to move legs to once a week, you can train legs, you know, heavy, say, on Wednesday in the weight room, do intervals Monday, Friday. That's probably doable for most people. Again, that sort of gets into sort of individual recovery issues. The other issue, you know, well, it's like I said, we've talked about, you know, two heavyweight workouts, two, three, depending on how you schedule it, multiple metabolic weight workouts is, you know, you can't do intervals 6 days a week. You just can't without something giving. And it'll probably, if it's not your brain, it'll probably be your knees, because just joints fall off when you train that intensely all the time. And this is an issue I had with a lot of guys who are like, intervals, is in my experience, most people, when they're dieting, do want to do something for exercise daily. And there's a number of reasons for that, whether it's to burn some calories, there's some evidence that helps some people with adherence. There's a weird mindset where if people train, some people find that they adhere to their diet better. There's kind of this mentality that, I've trained today, I'm not going to blow it by breaking my diet. Of course, others go the other way around. They go, I trained, I earned that milkshake, and that can backfire. You know, it's aerobics class syndrome. I did an hour aerobics class. I must have burned 1,000 calories. Now try about 300. I earned that milkshake and cheeseburger. Yeah, that was 2,000 calories that even if you had burned 1,000 in the class, you still out-ate it. And then why am I not losing any fat? Anyway, so for a lot of people, I find that there's an adherence, there's a coupling of activity and diet that can go together well. But if you're going to do something daily and you can't do high intensity every day, well, what does that leave? You're going to have to do low intensity activity. So when I set up programs, exercise programs, it's not that one is better than the other. I tend to have sort of a hierarchy of what I think is important. Like, if you're only going to do one type of activity, it better be heavy strength training. Like, if that's all you've got time to do, because that's what will maintain muscle. You can use the diet to generate the fat loss. Like, that's the single most important thing. If there's room, you can start to add these other things. So you can add metabolic weight training if you can schedule it. You can add intervals if you can recover from it. If you're going to do something metabolic daily, you probably are going to have to cut the intensity on many of those days. So it's just a matter of finding that balance of what folks can actually recover from and still allow them to train as or overtrain as much as they want to.
With, you know, you were talking about overtraining and the bodybuilders, and all they could really handle was the low intensity cardio. And I'm wondering if I could get you to comment on this, because I know we've all seen it. We've either had clients who have come up to us, or, you know, someone gets on a forum and posts this, and it's usually a woman, and yeah. They're always saying, I swear to God, I'm eating 1,200 calories a day, and I'm doing this training program, and it's like just a barrage of everything, and I'm not losing weight. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of factors that might keep them from losing weight. The first thing I'm always thinking is, you're totally lying to me about your diet. But is there a possibility that maybe they are eating that many calories, and they're doing all that training, and they're just overtraining, and their body's revolting?
Yes. The short answer is yes. The long answer is, the first thing I always look at is food intake, because people tend to drastically underestimate their true food intake and just be really bad at it. And the studies have borne this out, that people will underestimate their true food intake by 30 to 50% on average. And you've got someone who just swears up and down, I'm only eating 1,200 a day. And you go, okay, write it down, write everything down. Like, oh, that's 2,400. Right. That is as often as not the problem. And I've talked to some people who are like, that's always the problem. I disagree, because I've been there. I've done it myself, where I knew exactly what I was eating, I knew exactly how much I was training, and nothing was happening. I've seen it in clients where I literally, for various reasons, knew exactly how much they were eating, I knew exactly how much they were training, and nothing was happening. So, yes, and I think there's a couple things at work here. A lot of it, and women more so than men, but it can happen in men, with women, water retention messes up everything. Like, women get the short end of the stick on so many things in terms of fat loss and weight loss, and this is just another one of them. And as any woman can tell you, under normal circumstances across, you know, the menstrual cycle, depending, water retention, I mean, it's hugely variable, but it can range from one, you know, someone will gain 10 pounds across the course of their cycle. And even if they were doing exactly what they were saying, even if the numbers say you're losing 2 pounds of fat a week, if they're retaining 10 pounds of water, you're not going to see anything happen for 6 weeks. That water retention will mask any true fat loss. And even if you're using calipers or other measurements, like even with that, which should be able to get around it, I still find that will throw things off so bad. Of course, we all know women are obsessed about the scale. They should just either throw it out or only get on it once a month. Someone actually should make a computerized scale that will only let women weigh themselves once at the same time.
That would be awesome.
Actually, there's a good business idea. Anyway, so that's a huge part of it, is we've got the natural propensity for women to retain water, and that can really enormously mask things. But sort of more specific to your question, there is something else going on. And what I have seen, and there's literature to support this, of course, is when you combine these massive caloric deficits with these extremely high-intensity activities, frequently you get some really goofy hormonal stuff going on. And in this case, the real culprit is cortisol. And cortisol is, you know, what everybody loves to blame everything on right now. And there's, as always, there's always an element of truth to that. And one of the lesser known effects of cortisol is that it causes water retention. It actually cross-reacts with the mineral corticoid receptor, which is one of the receptors that binds the water-retaining hormones. And it has some affinity for that receptor. Now, it only sends about 1/100th of the signal, but there's something like 10,000 times more cortisol, so it can still end up having a really enormous effect. And they see this, you know, in Cushing's patients who have overproduced cortisol, after you get a cortisone shot, like, you will just bloat like crazy. So you get this situation where calories are really low, and when calories are that low, usually carbs have to be really low, and that can predispose towards increased cortisol. They're doing high-intensity activity every day, which tends to jack up cortisol, and they're just retaining water like absolute crazy. And there's an additional issue, And there's a certain, seeing how I can put this gently, there's a certain personality type that this tends to occur in to a relatively greater or lesser degree. And gently, we might describe them as being wound a little tight. And we've all kind of known this person who's just a little bit intense all the time. They're just, I wish we had a video because the facial expression would explain this better. They're just kind of, people can imagine what I'm doing. They're just always kind of like that, just all the time. And when it comes, and you can hear it, you can, if you listen, if you pay attention to their posts, you can almost hear the intensity in the stuff they're writing on the forums. It's, I've been eating 1,200 calories and I'm training 6 days a week and I just, I have to lose weight and what do I, like there's just this, or maybe it's just me, maybe I'm just dreaming. Like this, but I swear to God, like you can see, you can hear the people who are kind of mellow and you can hear these intense folks. And these are people that personality-wise, like I said, they tend to be described as just being wound a little tight and in a less, I'll just leave it there. They already tend to overproduce cortisol. Just that's their neurochemical pattern. And actually sort of on in that vein, I think the first place I read about this, there's a fantastic book I recommend to all your readers, listeners, called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers by Robert Sapolsky. And
it's great.
I'm sure people, book, seriously, people are like, what are your top 10 books? And if I could have one book, like if I was going to be on a desert, it'd be between that and one of my favorite fiction books. It's literally one of the best books I've ever read, and he's the writer that I want to be when I grow up, because he's taken he's a researcher. He studies stress physiology and cortisol in the lab during the winters, and he studies savanna baboons in the summers over in Africa. And he's written this unbelievably accessible book that tells you everything about cortisol and the stress system in not only a way that a non-scientist can understand, but that is just funny as hell. Like, you'll laugh reading this book about cortisol. It's fantastic. Anyway, he talks about certain personality types who are just, they overreact. Their bodies are just wound tight for whatever reason. And so they overproduce cortisol. And what I find is that these types of folks, they always think that they have to work harder, more, because they just, God, they have to lose weight. Whoops, hang on, I lost my microphone again. And it backfires. So they've got this propensity to overproduce cortisol in the first place, and then they overtrain and eat too little, and it just it magnifies. And what you have to get these people to do is relax. And one of my favorite stories, this was years ago when I was personal training and like most, thought I knew everything and realized in hindsight that I knew a couple things, maybe. And I had this client, and she was one of these types. And she came to me and was wanting to lose weight, and she'd never exercised. And she immediately jumped into what she claimed was like 400 calories a day. Like her diet, breakfast was half an egg, which is not a joke, by the way, because I couldn't make something that – I don't even know how you eat half an egg. And like a piece of diet bread, and then she'd have 2 tablespoons of tuna salad for lunch and some ridiculously low caloric intake. And then she was doing like training 6 days a week with 2 hours of cardio, and like nothing was happening. And I just, for weeks, I kept telling him, like, you have to just, all I knew at that point was too much exercise and too little food equals bad things happen. I didn't know why. I couldn't explain it. I just knew that that's bad. And told her, you need to eat less and exercise more. Well, that'll never work. Well, what you're doing right now isn't working, so why don't you just listen? And so anyway, she finally went on vacation, and she went on a cruise or something like that, and came back 5 days later, and I'll be damned, she lost like 10 pounds. And I was like, because what do? On a cruise? You sit around and you eat more. And I'm like, see? See? Do you see? I was right. And she went right back to doing the same thing, because she was nuts. And, which is the less polite way of describing these women who are wound a little bit tight. So with these women, like invariably, like they're the ones that there's a phenomenon that gets talked about on the internet, and I even wrote actually rather soberly about it in one of my books called The Stubborn Fat Solution, called the Whoosh Phenomenon. And I had seen this years ago in myself, and because again, I tend to be a little bit intense, as anyone who's talked to me knows. And when I was first back in my 20s, that was the thing. I'd stalled on one of my fat on my diet, and so what was my – just work harder, cut calories more, increase cardio, and it had the exact opposite result of what I wanted it to do. And it wasn't until I finally learned to just frickin' relax and moderate deficit, moderate activity that it worked a whole lot better. And what I have seen, there's a phenomenon called the whoosh phenomenon that people talk about. And you'll see people that are just stalled on their diet for days or often weeks. And some people are prone to it and some people aren't. And invariably what happens is you've got that person and they've been dieting and they get really annoyed and really tired because nothing's happening and the weight's not moving. And then they finally go, you know what? Screw it. I'm breaking my diet. And for 2 days, they go off and eat whatever they want. And they get on the scale Monday. And they've lost 5 pounds. Whoosh! And what I think is primarily happening is there's just this enormous water retention that tends to occur. And it's when you actually break the diet. You often see what I jokingly refer to as the long-term delayed fat loss effect, which anyone who's read Super Training will understand where that comes from. And I throw that acronym out there on forums just to mess with people sometimes, LTDLFLE. And they go, what's that? I can figure it out. And like we know these people, and bodybuilders even report it, that the week after they end their diet, they get leaner.
And they look better.
And they look better. And people have been dieting for 8 weeks, they break their diet for a week, and they get leaner for about the first 7 or so days. And people keep pestering me for a mechanism and just magic. That's the best I can do. Like, I have some theories, but they're not relevant. And, like, there's even studies that have found this. There was one I remember, they dieted folks for, like, 4 weeks really hard. And then they refed them for a week. They raised calories gradually. And during that fourth week, weight continued to go down. And it was just this, there's this long-term delayed fat loss effect. What can I tell you? So you see this situation where there's just this enormous water retention. You get them to go, you know, just, God, take a week off or just go to the low-intensity cardio so you're not stressing your body 24/7. And suddenly magic happens. There's actually a guy on one of my forums, same thing. And I think he was trying to make weight for a powerlifting contest and just nothing would move. And finally he sort of just cut back his training load and increased his carbs and calories a little bit. And he's like, I dropped, 3.5 kilos in 2 days because he was just holding such enormous amounts of water. And again, it doesn't happen to everybody. But it does, the folks it happens to, it's really pronounced. And the problem is it becomes this weird cyclical thing, is they already have this overreactive personality, which makes them crave harder work. And then when things don't move, they just figure they have to work harder, when actually what they need to do is relax and work less hard and stop training themselves so damn hard and eating quite so little. So that's a very long answer to that question. But yes, in most cases, is it problems with food intake? Yeah, but have I seen some real goofy things happen? Yeah, absolutely. And I think a majority of it is truly water retention.
Interesting. Yeah, my take on that is usually it's sort of like the body's evolutionary response to that kind of stress. Like, the body doesn't know what the hell's going on, and it's just like, well, I'm going to hold on to this fat because I don't know, what this person's, trying to do, and I might need this. It's sort of like the body puts a padlock on the fat cells, is the way I put it. That's not a very scientific term, but
yeah,
as soon as they relax a little and just, up their calories, it's like the body unlocks the fat cells.
Yeah,
does. It's weird.
Yep, and I know, and it seems, and it's totally counterintuitive, and that's the thing that's really so difficult to explain to people, and this kind of brings us full circle when you're asking about the flexible dieting thing, is mentally, when I used to eat, even again, before I kind of knew why or the what's or the wherefores, I knew that these strategies worked, and the idea to someone who's dieting like a maniac that by eating more and exercising less, or that by putting in, structured refeeds, which I didn't really talk about, but they're just periods of sort of deliberate high carbohydrate overfeeding that sort of break the hormonal cycle of dieting and raise leptin and have all these nifty, and refill muscle glycogen for performance and all these nifty things, that by doing that, that by almost being less hard on your diet, it works better, is really counterintuitive to people who equate, harder work is better. Harder work is how you succeed. And again, I think it's this weird Puritan work ethic, although for all I know, it's common among dieters all over the world. And what I find with people who read the flexible dieting guide, who've been on that train, like, they just find it really liberating. And they're just like, wow, this idea that I don't have to go more than 3 or 4 days before I can actually structure, quote unquote, forbidden foods into my diet is a real psychological relaxant. And it's just, it's human nature. It's take something away from someone and they want it more. And if you don't believe me, find a 5-year-old and take his toy away. And dieters are no different with food. If I told you can never eat a food again, assuming it's not probably asparagus or something that you don't like. Anyway, you're going to want it just from the simple fact that you can't have it. And if I told you you can never eat that again, that's all you're going to think about. And then eventually, it's not a matter of if you'll binge, it's a matter of when you'll binge. I can guarantee, with exceptions I can count on one hand, and at that point we're talking subclinical eating disorders, you will break your diet. I guarantee it. Now it's a matter of when you break it, are you going to be in control of it, or is it going to be in control of you? So I like to just plan those things in, and getting people to understand that in the long term, these things like refeeds and taking a diet break, which the full diet break, as I conceptualize, is, you know, 2 weeks, you bring calories back to maintenance, you bring carbs back to normal. It's basically kind of a stabilization cycle. You know, you've been dieting anywhere from 4 to 12 weeks, depending on lean body mass, initial body fat percentage and all these things, and you take a couple weeks and just eat normally, maintaining, you know, the good habits you've built, get your protein, eat your vegetables, get, you know, don't go from the great diet to, you know, the McDonald's, the buffet diet, but it just allows a little bit more flexibility. You allow some hormones to normalize. You allow you to sort of get used to that new weight. Then you can go back into active dieting, but you know that there's always a light at the end of the tunnel, you know, whether it's a free meal every fourth day, whether it's a refeed once a week where you get 5 hours to eat some of the starchy stuff that you're probably craving, whether it's a 2 week break every 6 to 8 weeks, it's not that you're dieting forever and ever and ever. And I think a lot of people in the field, especially those that are leaner, tend to forget about this with really overweight clients, is if you've got 100 pounds to lose, if you're looking at the standard, you know, 2 pounds a week, that's a year. That's a year's worth of dieting. If I told you I want you to feel deprived for a year, what do you think the odds are that you're going to do that? And I'd say the odds are pretty damn low. If I go, you know what, you don't have to, I want you to diet 8 weeks and then take 2 weeks to eat normally. And during those 8 weeks, every week, I want you to have a couple meals out with your family where you can eat something. Suddenly, just the psychology of it just changes completely. It becomes, rather than being this absolutely overwhelming period of just never-ending hunger and misery, it's like, okay, I can probably do that. And I mean, in training, we periodize training. There's never, you know, 6 to 8 week blocks where you're killing somebody before they're going to get a break or a 4 week deload or whatever it is. There's always a light at the end of the tunnel, except for my coach, but that's a whole separate thing. But in any event, he uses this model of just relentlessly gradual increases that there's never a break. But that's not – but for the majority of people, it's better to just – to have these breaks in, and psychologically, but getting people to understand that, I find it's like banging your head against the wall, because it is so counterintuitive. These women who aren't losing weight, who are training so hard, what do you mean doing less will make it work better? What do you mean that cutting out my 6 day a week Tabata thrusters, six will make me lose fat faster? Isn't harder better? Well, no, it's actually not. And again, athletes know this, good coaches know this, and dieters just always equate harder with better. And it ends up, you know, and then of course then they'll point, oh, but look at bodybuilders. They do 12 weeks, 16 weeks of that, and look how great they look. Mm-hmm. Look at them. Well, even, you know what, even among naturals, it works. Here's the thing. Where are they a month later?
Bloated back up.
The post-contest binges among bodybuilders are epic. They're legendary. Like 40 pounds in 2 weeks, some of which is water, mind you, but like it's just you've spent 16 weeks depriving yourself, eating a diet of chicken breast, broccoli, and oats 6 times a day for 16 weeks. Because there's this in bodybuilders, the psychology is if it tastes good, it's I can't eat it. Like you're joking, right? And it works up to a point. They look great on stage sometimes, and the post-workout binges are legendary. And that's the problem, is it works fantastically in the short term, and it works awfully in the long term. And I remember years ago when I was prepping my first bodybuilder, I was using sort of one of the proto-cyclical ketogenic diets, you know, low carbs for 5 days and then a one-day refeed. And again, I thought I knew what I was – I didn't know the whys and the wherefores at that point. I just knew that it worked. And, you know, once a week she got to have, you know, some muffins and some pancakes, and everyone in her gym was like, oh, that'll never work and that'll never work, until she came in and, you know, at 7, 8% body fat, and suddenly it was like, can you tell me about your diet? And after the show was over, she was fine. She had never really felt massively deprived. You know, it was only the last 2 weeks we had to drop out the refeed. And she had no problem going back to sort of a normal eating pattern. And the other bodybuilders at her gym, and there were a bunch of them, including one who was doing, you know, the 900 calories, 2 hours of cardio a day, and not losing anything but muscle, going back to that other question. After the contest was over, oh my God, the food binges just began in earnest, because when you deprive yourself for that long, for that extended period of time, it can only backfire in the long term, even if it works absolutely stunningly in the short term.
Wow.
That's great information there.
Really, really good stuff.
Do you think you have time for one more question?
Oh, sure. I got nowhere to be. Today's my one day off, so yeah, I'm free.
Oh, cool.
It's your refeed day.
Yeah, pretty much. This is the day that I lay around, eat more, and try to get ready to survive the next 6 days of suffering.
All right, let's just end with a question that kind of pertains to your protein book.
Yes.
And, you know, there's so much information out there. Obviously, bodybuilders are on the kind of extreme end with, you know, you need hundreds and hundreds. You know, some guys consume, I've heard, you know, 400, 500 grams of protein a day, which seems a little excessive and might give you some digestive disturbance.
Yeah.
And then there's the whole, you know, you need, you know, maybe 1 gram per pound might be adequate. And then, you know, there's all the research by Lemon and these other guys.
Yep.
Like what's your sort of synopsis of what would work? And obviously it depends on your goal, but I mean, what's
sure.
sort of like, I guess for your non-elite athlete, but maybe just your hard training sort of average person who just wants to have more muscle and look better. I mean, what do you need to do in terms of like how much protein per meal? I mean, what's your strategy for that?
Well, I'll answer that sort of two ways, which is one, to look at sort of daily totals, and then we can talk about per meals and get into that issue. Which is, yeah, you know, typically there's been this big debate between, you know, the classically trained dietitians say, the RDA, which is 0.8 grams per kilo, about 0.56 grams per pound, it's not very much, is all that anybody needs regardless of activity. And then you got the athletes who've always sort of contended and certainly felt that more protein was beneficial, as superior on one way or another. And then the scientists got into, you know, Peter Lemon, Kevin Tipton, Tarnopolsky, Stuart Phillips are kind of the big names in the research end of things. And they did various studies on endurance training and strength training and seemed to show pretty conclusively that yes, athletes need more. It's questionable how much more. There's a sub-argument that comes up, which is that, yes, athletes need more, but since they already eat such a meat protein-heavy diet, they already get as much as they need. They don't need to supplement. You know, around and around it goes. Part of the problem with a lot of the athletic literature is that the magazines are almost exclusively owned by supplement companies. Their recommendations have a commercial bias, which is they make their money not by selling a monthly magazine, but by selling dietary supplements. And protein powder is a perennial favorite. And if you can get someone, it's to get 500 grams a day from whole food is nearly impossible. That means buying expensive protein supplements, money is made. So there's been this long-standing debate. And I tend to sort of, it's when people look at myself, I tend to be kind of a middle of the roader on most things. Because when you look at sort of either the extreme position of anyone, usually the truth tends to be kind of somewhere in the middle. Like it's, you know, dietarily, the low-carb folks have some points. The high-carb folks have some points. For most people, somewhere in the middle is probably the best place to be, and there's always extreme exceptions, and people tend to get kind of blinded by their biases. So anyway, that's your original question, which is protein intake. I have a little bit of a tendency, you know, for years and years and years, I stuck with the standard 1 gram per pound of lean body mass, which has been sort of a classic value thrown at by bodybuilders for years and years and years. And that's actually a pretty reasonable number. Like some of the early stuff by Peter Lemon suggested, you know, 1.6 to 1.8 grams per kilo, which is a little less than 0.8 grams per pound. So, you know, the 1 gram per pound empirical rule is a pretty good one. Like it ends up to being right about where the research stands. Of late, at least looking at sort of the elite level, I'm starting to err a little bit more on the side of a little bit higher. It's turning out there's some pathways other than skeletal muscle that dietary protein supports, and I kind of at the elite level, which I realize your question was named at, I would rather err on the side of a little bit too much than a little bit too little. There's not really much detriment for an athlete to eat, you know, say 1.5 grams per pound of lean body mass, which is another common recommendation in the bodybuilding literature. It's not going to hurt them, assuming that they're getting enough carbs and fats to support other aspects of training. And most athletes have enough of a caloric expenditure that's not a problem. So I'd rather err a little bit on the side of too much than too little. For the average person, you know, I think the 0.8 to 1 gram per pound of lean body mass works just fine. It's not excessive. It's usually pretty achievable through food. As I mentioned at the first part of the interview, you know, lean protein has some other benefits in terms of hunger control, weight loss. You know, it has the most pronounced thermic effect of food, so it burns the most calories when you eat it. Studies have shown that higher protein intakes tend to not only limit total weight regain after a diet, but that the weight regain tends to be lean body mass rather than fat mass. I mean, there's enormous benefits to increased amounts of lean dietary protein, even for the general public. And it's going to be another 5 or 10 years before this really makes it the mainstream recommendations. But the literature is there. A researcher named D. Lehman has done a lot of work showing that higher protein intakes, you know, upon hunger and maintain blood sugar and recommending, you know, increased amounts even while dieting and yada, yada, yada. So I think that's a pretty reasonable, achievable level for most people. On a day-to-day basis, and I would mention that, you know, that is lean body mass. That question invariably comes up when I talk about protein requirements. You know, do you use total weight or lean weight? And, you know, for lean athletes, it doesn't really matter. A lean athlete at 10%, the difference in lean mass and total mass isn't significant. But if you've got an extremely overweight client or someone who's, you know, 250 pounds at 30% body fat, you know, so they've only got 150 pounds of lean body mass, 300 pounds of protein would probably be overkill for them. So you would want to, you know, you would want, or even if you've got, you know, a fat athlete, if you've got a big football player who's 30% body fat, you know, you don't need dietary protein to support fat mass. So I like to use lean body mass, assuming you can get a rough estimate of it. So yeah, I think 0.8 to 1 gram per pound is perfectly sufficient, and it's not going to cause problems. And most of the health risks that are attributed to dietary protein, whether it's the bone issue, has been
kidneys or something like it's going
to. Yeah, the kidney thing is, you know, somehow people went from it's been known for decades that people with kidney problems need to restrict protein. That doesn't mean that high protein gives you kidney problems. Somehow that logic got reversed, and the studies that have been done using intakes up to, you know, 2.5-3 grams per kilo, which is about 1.5 grams per pound, show no detriment to kidney function. If anything, it may actually benefit. You know, what they used to think was a marker of deteriorating kidney function in older folks, you know, decreased glomerular filtration rate, GFR, was a function of them eating less protein. It wasn't because they ate a lot of protein when they were younger, it's because they were eating less. The kidneys adapt to your protein intake, and there's really no evidence that dietary protein per se in those types of amounts are a problem. Same thing with the bone loss issue. You know, that's been floating around for absolute years, and it's always been interesting that while people will say, dietary protein causes bone loss, it's also been known that when you're healing from bone injury or like a bone break, dietary protein increases the rate of healing. And the people who are anti-protein should probably try to explain away that data point. And what it actually turns out, part of the issue is that high dietary protein intake with low calcium intake can cause problems. Mm-hmm. A high dietary protein intake with sufficient calcium intake causes increases in bone density. So the key is not the dietary protein per se, it's how much protein you're eating along with how much calcium you're getting. And I'm actually a big fan of dairy proteins anyway, and that's one of the reasons. Dairy calcium does lots of nifty things, body composition, lowers blood pressure, all kinds of good things that if you're going to eat a lot of dietary protein, you need to make sure you're getting sufficient calcium. I would also note in this regards that one of the recent issues that's come up is, you know, this whole acid-base balance,
right,
that a lot of people talk about. And if you'd asked me about it 10 years ago, I would have said it was a bunch of hippie nonsense. But there is actually something to it. And excessively high protein intakes by themselves can cause an increase in net acid load. That can cause some issues with bone density, a bunch of other health issues. The key is that you have to balance that base with lots of fruits and vegetables. You need to eat plenty of produce, which produces a base effect to counteract the acid effect of the protein. So it's not a matter that protein per se is the issue. It's again how it's interacting with these other nutrients. So that's sort of a quick look at the protein issue. Most of the health issues have been vastly overstated. Another one that comes up a lot is, you know, dietary protein causes heart disease. Well, no, fatty dietary protein causes problems. And somehow people have gotten this idea that if you're going to eat a high-protein diet, you have to get lots of dietary fat. And I'm not sure what – I mean, yes, they're looking at modern diets. Most people who eat lots of protein tend to eat fattier cuts, but you can – I can get lean red meat that's 4 grams of fat per 4 ounces. I can get lean chicken is nearly fat-free without the skin. Tuna is nearly fat – I mean, it's no problem to get low-fat protein sources. So there's also an issue that people who eat high-fat protein sources don't eat a lot of vegetables. Could maybe be the lack of vegetables as much as the presence of the high fat. You know, there tends to be a cluster of behaviors that go along with that, that people fixate on the one thing they don't like. So even a lot of that tends to, and even the thing with colon cancer seems a lot to be related to people who eat high protein diets often don't eat enough vegetables. Well, is it the presence of the protein, the absence of the vegetables? It's probably the combination of the two. So the point just being that, you know, find a little balance. A diet that's all vegetables isn't any better for you than a diet that's nothing but protein. So, you know, we need all these different foods from a nutritional standpoint. Anyway, so that's the protein thing. Back then you asked a question, do you really want me to get into the whole meal, protein per meal thing?
Well, I mean, if you want. I mean, if you just want to give sort of your synopsis of, you know, like the whole – you know, you can only absorb 30 grams or something in a meal, yeah. Or I mean, like, it would make sense to me to just be sort of eating it throughout the day whenever you eat. But I guess it's not, you know, if you have a meal that doesn't have a lot of protein, it's not the end of the world because you'll get it either later or prior,
yeah.
Right?
And that's been one of those things that again came sort of out of bodybuilders, and bodybuilders as a whole tend to be a little bit on the obsessive compulsive end of things. It's almost a more healthy type of eating disorder, but I'm not going to get into that too deeply. In any event, so there's this idea that, you know, A, that you must eat protein at every meal, and I think there's certainly some benefit to that, if nothing else from the standpoint of fullness and appetite suppression, and that idea sort of got taken into the body thing of, okay, well, you must divide your protein exactly evenly throughout the day. And then suddenly this argument came around that, you can only absorb 30 to 40 grams of protein per meal. And no one really defined what that meant. And it seemed a lot of it even came out of some of the supplement stuff. And I remember one company changing the value depending on what product they were selling. So when their product had 40 grams per serving, you can only absorb 40 grams of protein per meal. When they shifted it to 35, that value changed to 35. So there's not... In that sense, there's not really much truth to it. What you see is that when you eat more protein, it just sits in the gut longer. You know, the human body is really phenomenal. This kind of goes to a point somebody made earlier, which is, you know, our bodies are primed for survival under all conditions. And I've put this in, you know, I've described this as your body hates you. You know, your body does not want you to be a lean 190 pounds of muscle mass. It wants you to survive, and that usually means being skinny and carrying a little more fat so you can survive if the famine comes. And it's not going to waste protein because you ate 35 grams at a meal. You know, protein absorption is pretty enormously well regulated and extremely good up to I've never seen really a limit from a digestion standpoint. It simply sits in the gut longer. Something else people fail to realize is that solid proteins really take a long time to digest. I mean, one study I actually cited in the protein book showed that a whole food meal was still releasing nutrients into the bloodstream 5 hours later. This idea that if you don't eat every 3 hours, your muscles will fall off or whatever, is there's no basis to it. Meals just take, and bigger meals take longer to digest.
And so that's an interesting point. And I think, you know, because people are always like, oh, you have to eat 5 meals a day to lose fat. And wasn't there a study that looked at 5 meals a day or 3 meals a day, and the end result was, you know, at the end of the day, the net calories are the big thing that matters?
For the most part, the literature has mostly supported that. You'll find sort of these occasional oddities. You know, people love to cite the boxer study that apparently I'm the only one who's actually read the full paper, where they took boxers who were losing weight and they put them on 2 versus 6 meals a day. And the 6 meal per day group lost less muscle mass than the 2 meal per day group. Aha! Bodybuilders are vindicated. You must eat 6 times a day or your muscles will fall off. Right. People need to actually read the full study. And what they did was they gave these boxers, number one, an inadequate amount of protein. They were not – actually, both groups lost lean muscle mass. The 2 meal per group simply lost more. The other issue was that to control the diet, they were given liquid meals and liquid protein. And many liquid proteins do digest very, very, very quickly. So in that scenario, the 2 meal per day group was spending a really long period of time without adequate protein. And what you do find is that when protein intake is inadequate, meal frequency is just enormous. Like, you really do need to spread it out massively. And when it's adequate, it really starts to not matter. And I think the folks who are doing the intermittent fasting, which is, you know, I know you said you just had Brad Pilon on, who sure talked about this. You know, there are guys who are going 14 hours and then eating all their calories in 6 to 8 hours a day. Their muscles are not falling off. And they usually have a really big nighttime meal, and that may be digesting for, you know, 6, 7, 8 hours. They're also eating a lot of dietary protein. So these weird – a lot of the studies that find that the higher meal frequency is better, there's sort of these hidden confounds. A lot of them also tend to be sort of retrospective. Like, there's this whole thing, if you skip breakfast, you'll weigh more. Right, because people who are heavy often skip breakfast to lose weight. The cause and effect gets reversed a lot of the time. And it's not that skipping breakfast will make you fatter. It's that people who have gained weight often start skipping breakfast. So you get this weird – and same thing with the meal frequency. Frequently, people who eat more meals eat less because they're fuller. Interestingly, the literature from the 60s and the 70s said the exact opposite. It said snacks are bad because if you eat more frequently, you eat more calories and gain weight. So there's actually a good bit of literature that says if you eat more, eat more frequently, you gain weight. But in that case, they were adding snacks to their normal food intake. The studies that are separating the same daily calories across multiple meals, you're looking at sort of different models and different issues. And for some people, eating more frequently does keep them fuller and they eat less. And for some people, skipping a meal makes them hungrier later and they eat more calories. You know, but for the most part, if you're eating three to four relatively evenly spaced meals, you know, 5 hours apart of whole foods with plenty of protein, your body's really pretty much fine. You know, the protein is going to take 4 or 5 hours to digest and maintain an anabolic state. Of more amusement, and we would need an entirely another interview to talk about this, there's some evidence that eating protein too frequently could hurt muscle mass gains, which I find unbelievably ironic and kind of funny, but the literature is not well developed on this. There's a lot of theoretical inferences being made, and way more studies need to be done. But it's actually possible. It may be possible that eating protein too frequently is a bad thing. Clearly, bodybuilders have had success with that, so it's not quite as it's not super clear at this point. But in any event, you know, for the average person, it's great. Like, again, this kind of goes back to this extremity thing and being overwhelmed. And you know, everyone sort of says, bodybuilders are the leanest. They do all the best things. The average person must eat 6 meals per day and do exactly what and I mean, I've heard some really crazy things. People have to skip away, you know, sneak away to the toilet stall to eat chicken breast and rice because they can't be seen eating at their desk. And like, I know people, I've seen people on the internet, literally they can't function in normal society. Like, I can't go to a movie because it would cross one of my meal times. And if I miss my 3-hour feeding, my muscles will fall off and I'll go into fat storing mode. And it's just a bunch of BS. You know, the studies have shown in humans, if you fast for 3 days, your metabolism goes up by about 5%. And the IF guys, they know this. This idea that if you skip a meal, you go into fat storing mode is so much nonsense. Like, it happens in rats and mice. And rats and mice operate about, they live about 2 years. 7 hours for them is like a week for us. So they work on such a faster time scale that extrapolating from them just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So this idea that you must eat every protein in tiny amounts every 3 hours or your muscles will fall off, there's really no validity to it. You know, as long as you're getting sufficient amounts of solid food protein about every 4, maybe 5 hours, you're really fine. You know, and that for most people that works out to breakfast, lunch, pre-workout snack, maybe post-workout something, you know, and dinner, and they're okay. You know, people also forget that bodybuilders tend to be professional dieters, you know, pro bodybuilders. They train, eat, sleep, and inject, and that's what they do on a day-to-day basis. And I mean, that's their job, is to do those things, and trying to apply some of these things uncritically to the general public, it backfires. Somebody comes in as a new client, and if you hit them with, okay, you're going to have to eat every 3 hours, these perfectly tiny meals, they're just going to go, you know what, forget it. I can't do that. Like, it's such an overwhelming thing to try to jump into from the normal pattern. And it's generally just not necessary initially.
Yeah.
Wow. Great. Good stuff.
Yeah, that was awesome. You definitely gave us a lot of good information. I think everybody is going to, you know, really benefit from listening to this and getting some of the information. And we'd love to have you back sometime. I mean, Keats and I are our background's more into strength and conditioning, sports conditioning, and soft tissue therapy. So, you know, with soft tissue therapy, we're big on recovery, regeneration. We'd love to have you talk about that stuff as well, you know, as diet pertains to that. But right now, could you give the listeners your websites and where they can find out more about you and any upcoming projects and stuff like that?
Sure. The website, you can get there one of two ways. The main site is www.bodyrecomposition, that's all one word, bodyrecomposition.com, or just go to lylemcdonald.com and that will redirect you. So that's where all my articles are, and I update the site a couple times a week, or try to anyway, and you can find the books and get access to the support forums and through the site. Upcoming projects, you know, I'm always kind of working on a lot of stuff in my head, and I've been kicking around an idea for sort of a training book. You know, it's funny, I've kind of gotten pinned in as the nutrition guy, and that's certainly one of my interests. But, you know, I started life as an exercise physiologist, and training was really actually my primary interest in the field. So I've kicked around that idea. The problem being, I don't know that I have anything really to add that's different, new, or exciting, and I don't really like to just kind of rehash the same stuff. So that's a possibility. I'm actually currently possibly talking about a collaboration, and actually you guys will be the first ones to hear about this, between myself, Alan Aragon, Martin Birkin, who's another guy very involved in intermittent fasting. I'd highly recommend him as an interview if you're looking for someone who's doing some really good work. And another buddy of mine named, I'm going to mispronounce his name, Borge Fagerly. He's Swedish, and I can't pronounce that O with a line in it. These are all kind of folks that I know, and we have sort of different approaches to, you know, body recomposition, and we're sort of kicking around the idea of doing something where we all contribute some information on sort of how we have sort of different personality types and how we approach the topic, and I tend to be sort of the detail obsessed compulsive type, and Blade's a little bit more relaxed and more about autoregulation, and if we can make it work, and if we can, it'll probably be my fault because I'm really hard to work with.
At least you're honest about it.
I'm just an enormous pain in the ass. I think it'll be really, really just give people sort of a different exposure to some different things that all sort of work. And, you know, this goes back to that first question, which is, you know, commonalities versus details. If you look at successful programs, whether it's strength and conditioning, dieting, fat loss, and look at the commonalities, you find the commonalities are almost always the same. The details differ, and that's as much the philosophy of the coach, what works for a given athlete, but the details tend to be almost less relevant than getting the commonalities and the basics correct. So all of our approaches share commonalities, but we just have slightly different ways of going about it, and I think people will find something that matches either their individual needs or their psychological needs or what have you. So that's kind of what I'm working on now. There's also a super secret project that I actually meant I was going to try to run Patrick through earlier this week and ran out of time. That let's just say that it's a very different project for me. It is diet and training related, but it's nothing like I've ever written before. And it's something that's just, it's so cool that like when I write diet stuff, I'm always kind of interested in it, but this one is so cool that it's just too cool. And that's all I'm going to say, because I just, it is a super secret project, and it's going to, it changed the way I really looked at a lot of things when I sort of made a bunch of connections earlier last year. And I'm working out some details of it now and trying to figure out the best way to kind of bring it to life. But it's the people that I've exposed to it invariably, their responses range from super cool to I'm stunned to wow, this is just, they're usually pretty shocked by what comes out of it. So I'll just leave it at that as a teaser. Hopefully next year, depending on if I can get it done.
Wow. Sounds
great. I've got some details, so.
Yeah,
sounds awesome. Yeah.
I'm currently in the grinding part of doing research reviews, and this is kind of where my personality profile kind of becomes an issue. I'm real obsessed with anyone who's read my book, like the protein book. You look at the reference list and you're like, my God, because I think one of the chapters had like 150 some odd references, and I had this in the ketogenic diet book was worse, and had over 600 studies referenced in that thing. And when I tend to get involved in stuff, I tend to be a little bit obsessive compulsive about it, and I want to read everything on every topic, and then I get sort of sidetracked by some completely irrelevant minor topic that I'm just interested in, and I've spent the last 2 weeks grinding on a particularly just a minor subtopic that I'm going to spend like two paragraphs on in the book, but I'm so busy trying to figure it out for my own benefit that I'm kind of stalled on the writing. So
it's great though. I mean, it's good being evidence-based. Like, I mean, so many in this field, you know, they only use research when it's convenient. Like,
yeah,
the research doesn't support what they're saying, then, oh, research isn't real world. I'm a real world guy. Like, but then if the research supports what they're saying, they're talking about it.
Yep, I see that a lot, and it just absolutely annoys me to no end. Oh, well, study. You go, yeah, well, here's 12 that say you're wrong.
Yeah,
I don't believe in science. I'm real world, and how much do you deadlift? I get that one a lot.
Yeah.
I bench more than you, so I'm right. Like, okay, fair enough. Like, whatever works.
Awesome. We'll be sure to put the links up to your site. All the books are available in the store section of our website now as well. So thanks for coming on and giving us your time and the information. We really appreciate that. And if you guys have any questions or comments for us, please send them to realitybasedfitness@gmail.com, or just go ahead and leave the comments in the comment section of the blog right under the podcast. And we appreciate everybody taking the time to listen. And on behalf of Keats and myself, we'll see you guys next time.